From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yesterday, President Bush renominated 12 candidates for federal courts. Their nominations were blocked or slowed by Democrats during the president's first term. On today's Fresh Air, the battle over judicial appointments. We talk with Ralph Neese of the liberal group People for the American Way, which is committed to defeating the nominations of judges that it considers to be on the far right. Tomorrow, we'll hear from Boyden Gray, founder of the conservative group The Committee for Justice. Its goal is to help the president's judicial nominees win confirmation. Also today, TV critic David Bianculli reviews new DVD compilations of three TV shows, Miami Vice, Murder One, and Deadwood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, President Bush renominated 12 candidates for federal courts whose nominations were blocked or slowed by Democrats during his first term. Democrats say the nominees they have opposed are out of the judicial mainstream. Republicans are accusing Democrats of being obstructionist. The judicial battle is likely to intensify if Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist, who has cancer, decides to resign. Today and tomorrow, we'll discuss the divisions over judicial appointments. Tomorrow, my guest will be Boyden Gray, the head of the Committee for Justice, which is dedicated to defending and promoting the president's judicial nominees. Today, we're going to hear from Ralph Neese, president of the liberal group People for the American Way. The group opposes the confirmation of judges it considers to be right-wing ideologues. Neese has been president of People for the American Way since 2000. From 1981 to 1995, he was the executive director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. In that capacity, in 1987, he led the coalition that successfully blocked the confirmation of Judge Robert Bork when he was nominated to the Supreme Court by President Reagan. Can you give us an overview of the judges that President Bush might appoint in the Supreme Court and in the lower federal courts? And by an overview, I mean the number, the scope.
Many Americans are unaware that the president of the United States, George W. Bush, could get as many as 4 Supreme Court nominations over the next 3 or 4 years. In fact, one of the few things that George W. Bush and I agree on is that prediction. And we have to be very careful because all the Supreme Court decisions now are 5-4, 6-3, either way. With respect to appellate court judges, again, not many Americans know the real facts because the right wing and the Bush administration and Tom DeLay and Bill Frist and others try to give the contrary message. But George W. Bush has gotten more judges in his first 4 years than Bill Clinton, than Ronald Reagan, and H.W. Bush. He has had 204 confirmed out of the 214 who went before the Senate. Now, the 10 worst were filibustered. The Democrats were courageous enough to stand up and filibuster, and a filibuster, of course, means that you need 60 votes to confirm somebody, kept the very worst nominees from the appellate courts. But still, 95% of the Bush nominees were confirmed.
What are the typical decisions that the lower federal courts hear, the appeals courts?
Unfortunately, a lot of people don't pay too much attention to the lower courts. When the Supreme Court's at stake or when the Supreme Court has a vacancy, the nation pays attention. But when it comes to the appellate courts, most people feel, as generations of Americans have felt, that the appellate courts are there to follow the precedents of the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, for the last 15 or 20 years, that's not happened. There was a decision with the advent of the birth of the Federalist Society in 1983 to start pushing not just the Supreme Court to the right, but the district courts and the appellate courts. A lot of people don't realize the Supreme Court handles about 80 decisions per year. The appellate courts handle 30,000 cases per year. So for millions of Americans, the court of last resort is the appellate court. And too many of the appellate court judges, rather than following precedents, are making their own precedents, especially on the Fourth Circuit and on the Fifth Circuit. So these circuit court nominations are very, very important.
It's likely that Justice Rehnquist will retire and that President Bush will appoint a new Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. What is the importance of the Chief Justice?
The Chief Justice has many important functions that makes him or her very powerful. Obviously, there are 9 equal votes on the Supreme Court, but the Chief Justice can push the court in a particular direction through the sheer dint of personality and the responsibility of deciding, in many ways, who is going to write the majority decision, the decisions as to what appellate briefs will be accepted, requests for decisions by the Supreme Court, and, of course, the ability to forge compromises. We all remember from our history books the Warren Court and the tremendous advances with respect to Brown versus Board of Education and all of the civil liberties issues. Every court is in many ways defined by the Chief Justice, not always, but the majority of the time.
If President Bush appoints a new Supreme Court Chief Justice, he will be in a pretty unprecedented position in that the Supreme Court made the decisive ruling on his presidency, you know, on him winning the election, and then he'd be in the position of appointing a Chief Justice from among the people who made that ruling. I think this is unprecedented. Does that raise any questions for you?
George W. Bush owes his original election to two factions, the United States Supreme Court and to the religious right, the radical religious right, which forms his base, about 23% of his vote in the year 2000 and probably even more than 2004. He owes the radical religious right in a big way. If it wasn't for the radical religious right and the 5-4 majority in the United States Supreme Court, George W. Bush would not be president. And he has told them, I will nominate justices in the mold of Thomas and Scalia. I personally hope that he breaks his pledge. I hope he puts the country ahead of his political debts, ahead of his political obligations. I doubt it, though. I think that he has premised his presidency on a Scalia-Thomas court majority that will turn back the clock almost 70 years on civil rights, on privacy and reproductive rights, on the environment, on religious liberty, and a host of other issues that most Americans think are theirs forever.
Republicans are considering trying to end the Senate filibuster, end the ability of the Senate to legally filibuster, in order to prevent Democrats from using the filibuster as a technique to stop President Bush's judicial appointments. Orrin Hatch, when he was the head of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, called the use of filibusters in the appointment process unprecedented, unfair, dangerous, partisan, and unconstitutional. And he said they're creating a constitutional crisis. Now, I know that you disagree with that. Why do you disagree?
The filibuster has been used by the Senate now for over 200 years. And it really is what makes the Senate different than the House of Representatives. The Senate is the deliberative body, and the filibuster might be the most defining characteristic of the United States Senate. In fact, the reason I think why some Republicans are joining Democrats in opposing the efforts of Bill Frist and Karl Rove and George W. Bush to eliminate the filibuster is they don't want to turn the Senate into the House of Representatives. The filibuster has historically been used to block things when either side, and both sides have used a filibuster for over 200 years, when one side thinks something is so bad, so unconstitutional, so contrary to the country's interests, they try to block it by the use of the filibuster, by making the other side get 60 votes. The other reason for the filibuster, and this is a really, really important point to make, is it is what forces the parties to get together and negotiate, to compromise, and try to find a bipartisan consensus. And the founding parents of this country were so good, had so much foresight, because we're in one of those unique moments. In fact, this might be one of the most unique moments in our country's history, when one wing of one party controls the White House, the Senate, in the House of Representatives, and is very close to controlling the third branch, the Supreme Court. And in the House of Representatives, Tom DeLay can get to 218 votes anytime he wants. It might take 15 minutes, whereas in the case of the Medicare bill, it might take 3 hours, but he's going to get to 218 votes, a simple majority. What Bill Frist and Karl Rove want to do is turn the Senate into the House so that it takes only 50 votes, plus Dick Cheney's vote to break a tie, to have a slim majority to do whatever it wants. I would argue now that the filibuster and Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy are the only three remaining checks and balances in our entire federal system. Certainly, the filibuster is the last check and balance in the legislative branch, and the Supreme Court justices are the only two checks right now in the Supreme Court. This is vitally important to make sure that we do not have a situation where one party with a simple majority can do whatever it wants in this country. That is dangerous. That's contrary to the American way.
How many times have the Democrats used the filibuster in the past 4 years to block one of the president's judicial appointees? And do you consider that number obstructionist?
There have been 214 nominees before the United States Senate. 204, 95%, have been confirmed. There have been 10 filibusters. That is not excessive, especially when you consider that in the last 5 or 6 years of the Clinton administration, Orrin Hatch, along with John Ashcroft, Bill Frist, and Trent Lott, blocked 35% of Bill Clinton's circuit court nominees. 35% weren't even given a hearing or a vote in the Senate committee, let alone an opportunity to be filibustered or voted up and down on the floor of the United States Senate. What they did from 1995 to 2000, the right wing, was unprecedented. Certainly what the Democrats in the last 3 years have done is consistent with the history of the last 200 years, consistent with what Republicans and Democrats have done with the use of the filibuster.
My guest is Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way. He'll be back after a break. Tomorrow we'll talk with Boyden Gray, founder of the Committee for Justice, whose goal is to defend and promote the president's judicial nominees. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way, which is opposing judicial nominees it considers to be on the far right. We recorded our interview yesterday, just before President Bush renominated 12 judicial candidates whose confirmation was blocked or slowed by Democrats during his first term. What are senators supposed to consider when they're evaluating the merits of a Supreme Court nominee? What is considered fair and what is considered inappropriate to ask about?
When it comes to Supreme Court nominations, its competence, its character, and also judicial philosophy. When it's the lower courts, it should be competence and character. When there is a Democratic administration, the pendulum will swing slightly to the left. When it's a Republican nomination, the pendulum will swing slightly to the right. However, what happened is that the pendulum, when the Republican Senate was in control during the Clinton administration, the Republican administration put its hand on the pendulum and stopped it and created vacancies and perpetuated those vacancies. So when poor Senator Pat Leahy became chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee in June of 2001, believe it or not, there were 112 vacancies in the federal courts because of what Orrin Hatch and Bill Frist and John Ashcroft and Trent Lott had done. 1 year later, after Pat Leahy, selectively using the filibuster against the most extreme of the Bush nominees, but not using it in most cases, the judicial vacancy went down to about 43, the lowest vacancy rate in about 20 years.
President Bush had said that there are so many vacancies in the federal appellate in the federal appellate courts that it constitutes a crisis. And that's one of the reasons that's been used to support the end of filibuster, because if filibusters are used to block more judicial nominees, then that crisis would only increase. You're saying there isn't really a crisis. And you're also saying if there is a crisis, it's because Clinton nominees were blocked so that there were vacancies.
There certainly was a crisis when Senator Pat Leahy took over in the summer of 2001. And Senator Leahy and Senator Daschle and others took care of that crisis. I think sometimes the president uses the crisis word a little bit too frequently. He's using it now with respect to Social Security when there's not one. He's used it in other international contexts, and now he's using it with respect to the judiciary context. There is no crisis. Whatever vacancies that there are remaining are the result of that effort to erect an ideological blockade during those last 5 or 6 years of the Clinton administration. And remember, the Republicans have been in charge of the United States Senate for the last couple of years, and many people were never brought to the floor. But the main point here is that the reason you have checks and balances, the reason you have the possibility of using a filibuster, is hopefully to help promote bipartisan consultation, negotiations, compromise, consensus. What this administration fails to do, unlike any other administration that I've ever seen, and I've been here in Washington serving Republican senators, working with Republicans and Democrats, I've never seen anyone as partisan as George W. Bush, any administration or any Senate as partisan as the ones that we have now. What they've got to do is what has happened over the last 220 years. Sit down and compromise. Sit down and negotiate and reach that bipartisan consensus. And then those remaining vacancies could be very quickly addressed, and we could have a much better judiciary and a much better system of government.
You've used the word worst. You've said that the Democrats have only blocked the worst of the judicial nominees. What do you mean by the worst? I want you to choose a nominee that was blocked by the Democrats who you consider to be among the worst, and tell us why you're using that word to describe them.
I could probably give you many examples, but let me use one to start off with. Priscilla Owen, who is a judge on the Fifth Circuit and is probably considered a possibility for the Supreme Court, even though she was defeated by the Senate a couple of years ago. Priscilla Owen was before the Senate Judiciary Committee and was subsequently filibustered by the full Senate. And one of the key issues was how Priscilla Owen was ruling on a range of issues in the Texas Supreme Court, issues with respect to reproductive rights, with respect to employment discrimination cases, with respect to business versus consumer issues, and a host of other issues that came before that court. Interestingly enough, Alberto Gonzalez, now the Attorney General of the United States, was on the same Texas Supreme Court. On issue after issue after issue, the Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen would rule and misinterpret or reinterpret what the Texas state legislature had ruled on a particular case, most notably on a range of reproductive rights decisions, but also on other kinds of issues before the court. So here is a good example of someone who had an extreme judicial philosophy with respect to civil rights, with respect to consumer rights, and with respect to reproductive rights and privacy. But what made her especially extreme was she allowed her personal ideology to trump her responsibilities as a judge. She did not act consistently with the law. She, rather than interpreting the law, made the law. In fact, it was so egregious that Alberto Gonzalez, on 11 different occasions, said that she was guilty of judicial activism, saying at one time an unconscionable act of judicial activism. She was far to the right of Alberto Gonzalez, now the Attorney General of the United States Department of Justice.
You said you think that William Pryor is likely to be among the first judges to come before the judiciary for the federal appellate courts. You think he is extreme. You would like to see his nomination blocked. What qualifies him as extreme in your judgment?
My guess is William Pryor. It's hard to say who is the most extreme, Priscilla Owen or Carolyn Kuhl or Janice Rogers Brown or William Pryor, but William Pryor has to rank in the top one or two, especially with his extraordinarily intemperate, injudicious views with respect to the Supreme Court and the kind of language he used to criticize the Supreme Court on one decision after another. certainly at the top of his criticisms of the Supreme Court were those concerning Roe versus Wade and Roe versus Wade's progeny over the last 20, 30 years. And he went to great lengths, speaking in many different forums, to be very critical of the Supreme Court itself with respect to reproductive rights and freedom. He also was one of the first and most early proponents of Judge Roy Moore, and you might remember the showing of the Ten Commandments or the display of the Ten Commandments in the courthouse in the Capitol in Alabama. And Roy Moore made a crusade out of this and continued to display the Ten Commandments to the defiance of both the lower courts and ultimately to the higher courts. But the United States government and states government cannot impose one religious view over another. So William Pryor, with respect to the First Amendment, with respect to reproductive rights and privacy, with respect to employment discrimination and civil rights generally, and I can go on and on and on, is certainly at the very extreme of the American judiciary with respect to his judicial views, and that's why he was filibustered successfully in the Senate.
Ralph Neese is president of People for the American Way. He'll be back in the second half of the show. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Boyden Gray, the founder of the Committee for Justice. Its goal is to defend and promote the president's judicial nominees. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. And from the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to stay active, eat right, and make brain health a personal and national priority at alz.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about judicial appointments with Ralph Neese of the liberal group People for the American Way. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews three DVD compilations of TV shows, Miami Vice, Murder One, and Deadwood. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ralph Neese. Since 2000, he's been president of People for the American Way, a liberal group which, among other things, opposes the confirmation of federal judges it considers to be far-right extremists. The group is poised to oppose any nominees to the Supreme Court that it considers extremist. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Boyden Gray, the founder of the Committee for Justice. That group's goal is to support President Bush's judicial nominees and help them win confirmation. Let's get to the Federalist Society. This is a very large group that I think is unfamiliar to a lot of people. Many of President Bush's judicial nominees belong to the Federalist Society. Let's start with an overview. What is the Federalist Society?
As opposed to what the Federalist Society says it is, which they say is a debating society that just wants to develop the issues, it is a very partisan, effective, right-wing organization of lawyers that's been around for about 20 years. It once was on the outside. It's now on the inside. It runs the White House Counsel's Office. It runs the Department of Justice. It runs most of the federal agencies. When I talked about the most extreme of the federal judiciary nominees, well, the Federalist Society is the most extreme of the organizations out there with respect to judicial philosophy. By the way, I just learned in the last week or so that the Federalist Society has hired the same consulting firm, PR firm, that did the Swift Boat Veterans that campaigned against John Kerry. They're going to use that same firm, which is notorious to say the least with respect to its inaccuracies, to represent them when it comes to the federal judiciary and the fight over Supreme Court vacancies.
What is the Federalist Society's judicial philosophy?
The Federalist judicial philosophy is a philosophy, and we're not talking here about good versus evil. We're talking about dramatically different judicial philosophies. And the Federalist Society believes that for the last 70 years or so, the Constitution has been in exile. The Federalist Society wants to go back to a 19th century perspective on the interpretation of the constitutional first principle, strict construction, original intent. The Federalist Society disagrees with how the Constitution has been interpreted since 1937. They disagree with how the Commerce Clause has been interpreted, the Spending Clause has been interpreted, privacy, the 14th Amendment. This is what the fight is all about. This is what the Bush administration is trying to do. Get a Supreme Court, get a judiciary that agrees with the Federalist Society to undo 70 years of constitutional history, which will also eliminate, by the way, the constitutional basis of progressive government. So in one fell swoop in the next 3 years, we could lose not just the last 70 years of judicial precedents affecting the environment and civil rights, reproductive rights, and privacy, but also the constitutional basis for future progressive government.
You said that the Federalist Society wants to interpret constitutional law as it was interpreted before 1937. What were the decisions in 1937 that they want to predate?
The 30 or 40 years just before 1937 was the Lochner era, and that was when the Supreme Court reigned and was able to veto progressive legislation passed and enacted by progressive legislatures and by progressive presidents. Some of us might remember from our history lessons the child labor laws and the child welfare laws. All of those were vetoed by a very right-wing conservative Supreme Court. Many of us will also remember that in our first 4 years of the New Deal, those first 4 years were pretty much vetoed by the Supreme Court. It wasn't until 1937 when the Social Security Act was upheld constitutionally. 1937 was the Spending Clause reinterpreted to favor the average American. And then between 1937 and now, the Supreme Court reinterpreted not only the Spending Clause, but the Commerce Clause, the 14th Amendment, Equal Protection Clause, privacy, and many other constitutional provisions. This, for many of us, has been a second American Revolution in which many of the dreams and aspirations of the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution have been given some measure of reality. Millions of Americans have been beneficiaries of these last 70 years. But for the Federalist Society, for the Bush administration, for Bill Frist and Tom DeLay, these 70 years have been an anathema. They want to overturn these 70 years. They want to repeal these 70 years. They want to get back to the Lochner era, to the 19th century perspective on the Constitution.
Wouldn't they say that the people who agree with you were ideologues? You say it's a second American Revolution. That sounds very radical. Wouldn't they possibly say that you're the radical ones, you're the ideological ones?
Well, the first American Revolution was radical, and the second American Revolution was radical. The second American Revolution was also bipartisan. These decisions have been rendered by both Republican and Democratic justices. In fact, since 1950, 60% of the justices have been Republican. Right now, 7 out of 9 of the justices are Republican. All the laws of the last 65 or 70 years have been passed with overwhelmingly bipartisan majorities. For 70 years, we've had a bipartisan consensus on protecting clean air and clean water, or having equal opportunity in education, employment, voting, and housing, or with respect to reproductive rights and privacy. These have been enacted or been interpreted by the Supreme Court over the last 70 years, not every time in the same decade, but over a 70-year period, we've had this bipartisan Second American Revolution.
My guest is Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way. He'll be back after a break. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Boyden Gray, founder of the Committee for Justice. Its goal is to defend and promote the president's judicial nominees. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way, which is opposing judicial nominees it considers to be on the extreme right. We're talking about the Federalist Society. Who are some of the better-known people who are in the Federalist Society?
The founders of the Federalist Society were Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia, Boyden Gray, John Ashcroft, and John Ashcroft's crew at the Department of Justice, the Solicitor General, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, the Assistant Attorney Generals for all the other departments, General Counsels at most of the executive branch agencies, Orrin Hatch. I could go on and on and on. The Federalist Society lawyers control much of the executive branch and much of the leadership of the House and the Senate at this time. These are the right-wing ideologues who are lawyers who have been part of this Federalist Society since its inception in 1983, and they have a point of view, which is to take back the law before it was at the time of the New Deal. It's a very radical, very reactionary point of view. But they are no longer the outsiders. They are the insiders. They are in control right now of the federal government.
You say about the Federalist Society that instead of advocating piecemeal change, one lawsuit and one bill at a time, the society seeks to produce much broader change by altering the entire legal landscape. What do you mean?
That's a great question. When I was at the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights in the early 1980s, and I just finished 8 years as a Republican chief counsel to two senators and took over the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. And we had a series of remarkable victories in 1981 and 82 and 83, and were able to defeat the new right leaders. Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush were president and vice president, and I think that the right expected to win everything because of what had happened to the presidency and what had happened to the United States Senate. But the Congress was still bipartisan, and the moderates and the liberals were still winning. Hence the formation of the Federalist Society in 1983, 1984. And they thought the only way to make sure that the right-wing revolution was complete and long-lasting was to take over the federal judiciary, not just the Supreme Court, but the appellate courts and the district courts. That's how it started in 1983, and they can still work to try to influence legislation or influence case by case, as they sometimes do. However, what they really want is a much more revolutionary, much more breathtaking wide array of decision-making, and that's the decision-making by the judges and justices at the appellate and Supreme Court levels. They want to move to the court way to the right. Once they get in there, once they can reinterpret the Commerce Clause, once they can reinterpret the Spending Clause and the 14th Amendment and privacy, they can lock those decisions in maybe for 30 or 40 years and not just undo or overturn 70 years worth of precedents, but by doing so, by the reinterpretation of those clauses, they can take away the constitutional basis for progressive government. Take away maybe for 30 or 40 years. It could render moot who becomes president or who controls both the House and the Senate.
The ABA, the American Bar Association, used to be the group that vetted nominees prior to their official nomination. In other words, if a president wanted to nominate a judge, the ABA would vet that nomination first and report back to the president. President Bush changed that. He's using the Federalist Society, not the American Bar Association, to vet his nominees. What do you think is the significance of that?
The significance is that has been a recommendation of the Federalist Society since 1983. I'm not exactly sure of the reasoning because the American Bar Association, while an important part historically going back to the Eisenhower era, judging the technical expertise and the competence, legal competence and the character of the nominees, that's an important function, but it never got into judicial philosophy or judicial ideology. So it did serve an important function for the senators and for the executive branch, and probably helped prevent those nominees who would have been an embarrassment to those nominating them. But they played an important role, but not that much of an important role. But the Federalist Society from the beginning didn't want any competition. They wanted to be the only ones involved in advising the executive branch on what to do. But not only did they get to advise the executive branch, they controlled the two offices, Office of Legal Counsel at the White House and the Department of Justice, that actually recommends to the president who the nominees are going to be. So the Federalist Society has been in charge of every part of the process.
And in 1997, Orrin Hatch, who was then head of the Judiciary Committee and a member of the Federalist Society, announced that he would no longer consider the ABA as being as having the official Senate role in the confirmation process of vetting nominees for federal judges. He had the Federal Society do that as well.
That's true. I'm pretty sure that the Federalist Society had taken that position for some time prior to 1997. That was the first time Orrin Hatch took that position. And, of course, once George W. Bush became president in January of 2001, I think within a couple of weeks they adopted the position of the Federalist Society.
Does your objection to the Federalist Society go beyond the fact that your politics are really different than theirs, that your judicial philosophy is really different than the Federalist Society judicial philosophy? What is your objection in terms of the way you perceive them operating? Because I believe you're objecting to that as well.
My problems with the Federalist Society, number one, are, of course, our differences with respect to judicial philosophy, but maybe as important, if not more important, I think the Federalist Society has been absolutely dishonest. I think they mislead the American people, the Congress, the press, and everybody else. The Federalist Society likes to come across and calls itself a debating society, and it has many different kinds of original thinkers who are part of this debating society. And of course, they love to invite people for the American Way and other progressive organizations to the table to debate the issues of the day. Well, they do sometimes conduct debates, but they are not a debating society. They are a close-knit organization of 20 or 30,000 lawyers across the country with extraordinary power in the Bush administration, throughout the executive branch, in the Congress, in the Senate. They have a point of view, they have a judicial philosophy, and they want to turn the clock back 70 years. They want to go back to a pre-New Deal type of government. And if they want to do that, they should say that's what they want to do.
Ralph Neese, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was my honor and my pleasure.
Ralph Neese is president of People for the American Way. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Boyden Gray, the founder of the Committee for Justice. Its goal is to defend and promote the president's judicial nominees. Monday on Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with clarinetist and composer Don Byron. His latest album, Ivy Divey, is dedicated to Lester Young. Here's a track from it, I Found a New Baby. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews new DVDs of Miami Vice, Murder One, and Deadwood. This is Fresh Air. Even though February is ratings sweeps month for television, when the networks try their best to attract viewers, TV critic David Bianculli says he's drawn more to the impressive releases of TV series on DVD. Among the current releases, he says, are shows from three different decades that all tried something original and succeeded.
Three new DVD box sets, each presenting the entire first season of a pioneering TV series, were released recently on the same day. From the 1980s, there's NBC's Miami Vice, which forever changed television by injecting rock music into the dramatic narrative. From the 1990s, there's ABC's Murder One, which predated 24 by devoting an entire season to one self-contained continuing storyline. And from the current decade, just last year, comes the first season of Deadwood, the boldly different new Western series from HBO. Miami Vice, which premiered in 1984, took the then-fresh energy of MTV videos and applied them to the standard buddy cop drama. Anthony Yerkovich created the series, and producer Michael Mann was the guy obsessed with both the visuals, all those pastels, all those defiantly cinematic camera angles, and the music. It's difficult to watch dramatic TV these days, from The West Wing and ER to Gilmore Girls and Desperate Housewives, without encountering a montage, usually at the end of the hour, backed and framed by a rock song with vocals. It's so commonplace now, like the handheld jittery camera work from Hill Street Blues, that it's hard to remember a time when it was new. But it started with the pilot of Miami Vice, specifically when In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins was used in the show's climax. Don Johnson, as undercover cop Sonny Crockett, is on the way to a potentially deadly after-dark showdown with a drug dealer. But he stops along the way, on his rendezvous with Destiny, to use a payphone to call his ex-wife, played by Belinda Montgomery, who's serving dinner to their young child. That's one way to gauge how old Miami Vice is. This is the era before cell phones. But the integration of dialogue and music, so groundbreaking then, still sounds fresh.
Well, you told me you were drowning. I would not end the
land. Don't do that. Come on, use your spoon. You know better than that. No. Hello.
Caroline?
Sonny?
I need to know something, Caroline. The way we used to be together. I don't mean lately, but before. It was real, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You bet it was. Sonny, what's wrong?
Nothing, Caroline.
Universal Home Video's Miami Vice release contains that movie-length pilot, as well as all other shows from the first season. The extras are disappointingly dated and thin, but the shows themselves are worth the purchase. Not only for the piece of TV history they provide, but for early glimpses of such future stars as Bruce Willis, Jimmy Smits, and Ed O'Neill. From the 90s, and from Fox Home Entertainment, comes Murder One, the Stephen Bochco courtroom series from 1995. Daniel Benzali from NYPD Blue stars as a gruff but moral defense attorney, with Stanley Tucci as his much less principled client. The breakthrough here is that the primary murder case, from initial arrest to jury selection, trial, and verdict, stretched over 23 one-hour episodes. And they're all here in this box set. Think of it as 23 rather than 24, but requiring the same viewer commitment and offering the same complexities. Its supporting cast boasts three wonderful actresses, Patricia Clarkson, Donna Murphy, and Bobby Phillips. And Murder One is a perfect series to watch on DVD, seeing the episodes as quickly or as slowly as you want. Best of all, though, is HBO Video's new release of Deadwood, the Western from David Milch of NYPD Blue fame. It's a series with such rough language and content and characters, it takes a lot of getting used to. I wasn't sold on Deadwood until episode 6, but by then, I considered it one of last year's very best programs. The acting, particularly by Keith Carradine as Wild Bill Hickok and Ian McShane as town patriarch Al Swearengen, is magnificent. Both of their characters are based on real-life residents of the actual town of Deadwood. But Milch has added lots of fictional characters and touches, all to explore human nature at its best and worst in a dazzlingly different Western. And the extras here are about as good as DVD extras get. There are documentaries and audio commentaries, and even a pair of special segments in which actor Carradine interviews creator Milch about various aspects of Deadwood, and gives us special insight into the weird workings of David Milch's inner muse.
Now you've created, you've captured in a big way the imagination of a large and really rabidly enthusiastic audience with what you're doing here. It looks like you're going to be here for a while. You know, the forces of nature willing.
Yes. As they say, if you want to hear God laugh, tell him your plans.
Exactly. Yeah. That was the line in episode 12. Yeah. How true. Yeah. So knowing that you're probably going to be able to do this for a while, you don't strike me as somebody who has a master plan in that way. It seems as though you have picked a road to go down.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And that's what you're going to do
and
is just keep going
walk
down
on it. As long as you know God intends that. And I've never been on any road that I didn't find interesting. You just have to know how to look. What allows you to look and to see is humility, which doesn't require of the road that it conform to your expectations or your previous experience of roads.
Any of these three DVD sets, Miami Vice, Murder One, and Deadwood, will provide hours and hours of entertainment. All of them are as worthwhile as most of what's on TV today, which is why I continue to get excited by the release of new box sets of old TV shows. Oh, and the second season of Deadwood, by the way, is just around the corner. Deadwood returns March 6th on HBO.
David Bianculli is TV critic for Fresh Air and the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with a song by Harold Arlen. He was born 100 years ago today. He wrote many songs that have become standards, including Over the Rainbow, I've Got the World on a String, Let's Fall in Love, Come Rain or Come Shine, That Old Black Magic, Blues in the Night, and I Got a Right to Sing the Blues. Here's a 1933 recording by the Leo Reisman Orchestra featuring Arlen singing his song Stormy Weather.
Don't know why. There's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather sends my gal and I together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere, stormy weather just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time. The time, so weary all the time. When she went away, the blues walked in and met me. If she stays away, old rocking chair will get me. All I do is pray the Lord above will let me walk in the sun once more. Can't go on, everything I had is gone. Stormy weather, since my gal and I ain't together, keeps raining all the time, keeps raining all the time.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our discussion about Supreme Court and judicial appointments. We talk with Boyden Gray, founder of the Committee for Justice. Its mission is to help the president's judicial nominees win confirmation. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.